clear exactly what happens between the end of Shmos and the beginning of Vayera. Moshe's attempt fails. This is restarting the process of Gulas Yisrael. We'll talk about that a bit later. But there's a parsha shift. And with the parsha shift comes a whole new consciousness for Moshe. Hashem is very clear to Moshe that at this point he'll be exposed to a level of understanding HaKadosh Baruch Hu, a relationship with Ribono Shel Olam, that even the Avos, with all of their accomplishments and all of their achievements, even the Avos weren't able to apply. And there's a lot of theology in the beginning of here. I'm not going to discuss any of that. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe, the Avos, they understood me through one vein, through one track. They saw me as Shakai, Shin Dalet Yud. And indeed, most of Sefer Bereishis is laced with the word Shakai, Shin Dalet Yud. In fact, after Sefer Bereishis, the word Shakai disappears and hardly appears until Sefer Iyov, when it reappears. So Shakai is the way that the Avos saw Hashem. I was actually just speaking to someone today, one of the boys in Yeshiva. He was telling me about a religious experience he had when he thought about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when he thought about the Ribono Shel Olam. And he kept saying the word God and God and God. And I told myself, I don't want to say it to him. But I told myself, okay, that should be one way you refer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but it's so much more intimate when you call him the Ribono Shel Olam, you call him HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I mean, you don't want to all of a sudden sound like Tfilas Yom Kippur, but, okay, there's nothing wrong with saying the word God, but you want to make your relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu as intimate as possible. You want to be able to see him in different ways, as a father, as a creator, as a scientist of the entire world, the author of our cosmos, as a redeemer of history, as a Melech Malchut B'Salel. And sometimes that word, I think the problem is it universalizes Hashem. And there's a danger in universalizing the Ribono Shel Olam, rather than having that balance between the universalism of being a Jew and the parochialism of having a national arc and a national narrative and historical mission. We've talked about that so many times. This person in a community in the United States who has a discussion group Friday night, so he sent me an article written a few years ago by a correspondent of a newspaper in America, a Jewish newspaper called The Jewish Week. Actually, I'm in front of that correspondent, and they were going to discuss this over their Friday night discussion. He wanted my input. It was a very well-written article. Maybe I'll try to reproduce it for you and hand it out. And it was about 2 years ago, before the Occupy Wall Street protests and the Occupy and the social agendas. Basically, his point was the hijacking. He's an Orthodox Jew, but he's obviously writing for a broader spectrum of Jewish readership. And the point of his article was the hijacking of the term Tikkun Olam. Tikkun Olam, taken from Eleinu, means L'taken Olam B'Malchut Shakai. It has a very, very ardent religious platform to bring religion into our world, to bring presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to destroy the Rishayim. L'taken Olam B'Malchut Shaddai, V'chol B'nei V'asar Yikru B'Shmecha, L'ha'avir Gidolim Min Ha'aretz. All the evildoers should be removed. There's a religious moment and content, there's a theological content to it. And somehow in our world, Tikkun Olam has become a platform for Jews laboring for social justice, social agenda, doctors helping the world in ways that sometimes run very far from classic ritual and Torah study and tefillah and davening. Almost becomes a replacement in some cases for Tikkun Olam and in its original intention. Now obviously we don't shy away from the modern connotation of Tikkun Olam having a role in our world, trying to contribute to this world, but it has to be a balance between our Tikkun Olam and Api Kabbalah. The first employment of the term Tikkun Olam has nothing to do with social justice and human welfare and being a doctor or solving the world's ills. Tikkun Olam comes from Kabbalah, and Kabbalah Tikkun Olam means that you're part of a larger cosmic process. And when the world was created, the cosmos was thrown into division. And you're trying to reunite b'shem yichud kutshu. And the more Torah you learn, the more mitzvahs you do. You're not changing Melbourne. You're not changing Johannesburg. You're not trying to improve Israeli politics or heal this person's illness. But the more mitzvahs you do, the more Torah you study, the more avodas Hashem you perform, the more that greater upper world that you're not physically part of, but you're spiritually part of, are being redeemed. So it has a very, very different connotation than a focused investment on what's happening in my society. There's a sense that I belong to societies that are larger than my historical personal context. Not societies, but worlds and realms. And I have to be sensitive to those realms, not only sensitive or sometimes lost in my own realms. Sometimes we lose sight. And I was just thinking to myself whether that phrase, Sometimes he obviously used the word God, and to be honest, I'm happy he used that, because some people today have written HaKadosh Baruch Hu out of religion entirely. Religion has become mitzvahs, religion has become halacha, religion has become ethics, religion has become Jewishness, and people are afraid to talk about their Ribono Shel Olam, and that's such an essential part of your life. Your keshev with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the way you serve him and talk to him and daven to him and study and fulfill his will, sometimes don't fulfill his will, but that's a lifelong process of living with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I'm happy that he's actually mentioning the Ribono Shel Olam, but sometimes I have to be careful to use jargon that carries that personal intimacy and also carries the special relationship we have as Yidden with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's just the God of Aristotle or the God of Plato or the God of other religions, even monotheistic religions. So the Avos received Shakai. Let's read the first Pasuk. Vayigaber Elokim el Moshe vayom elav ani Hashem. I appeared to them through Kel Shakai, line number 2. Ushmi Yudke Vavke, Ushmi Hashem. I didn't display, I didn't teach them Yudke Vavke. To you, I will orient Yudke Vavke. To you, I will disclose Yudke Vavke. Now, again, I don't want to elaborate on the theology. What is the difference between Shakai and Yudke Vavke? But it's clear that at least at this junction, Yudke Vavke is presented to Moshe as superior, more revelatory, more epiphanious than Shakai. There's something more. The others, they received Shakai. But to you, Yudke Vavke. To you, EPI. To you, George, EPI. To you, Yudke Vavke is going to be a step up, an upgrading. Not just Shakai, but Yudke Vavke. Why? Why? What did Moshe accomplish, certainly to this point, that warranted his upgrading? I mean, we read about the Avos in Avram's Akedah. Moshe didn't undergo an Akedah yet. Yitzchak, ditto. Moshe never sacrificed his life to the degree that Yitzchak was. Yaakov Avinu, a lifetime of commitment and vision. Why was Moshe Zochet to Yudke Vavke at this early stage, preliminary stage, when the Avos warned Zochet, even at the latter stages of their career? And the answer follows in the immediate section, and it's a crucial, crucial answer. And it's a crucial message and lesson about how we relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and it's an ironic one. It's one that we wouldn't necessarily agree with or understand or support if HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't teach it to Moshe in Parshas Vayikra. Why? Well, the rest of the Pesukim you know. Source Aleph. V'gam hakim osius b'si yitam l'seis lem eseretz kinan eseretz megrahim eshe garuba. Because I am about to fulfill the covenant. L'chein amar l'vnei Yisrael ani Hashem v'otzeiti etchem me'eretz Mitzrayim v'itzalti etchem v'lakachti etchem v'heveti etchem al aretz asher nasasi et yadi l'seis osu l'avam Yitzchak l'Yaakov. Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, for all their accomplishments, for all of their leadership, for all of their heroism, they were the heads of clans, of tribes, of families. Avraham hardly had a clan. People that were his family. He had part of his entourage, people that he inspired. But slowly, this entourage coalesces around the family, and those individuals become 70. But it's still a clan. It's still a family. In Parsha Shemos, these two parshas, we are witnessing the genesis of a nation, or the metamorphosis of a family into a nation. That's why Shemos begins with repeating the 70 people who descended to Mitzrayim. Famous Rashi. Why does it repeat the names that are already counted in Parshas Vayigash? So Rashi and Shemos has his opinion. Shem is showing Chiba, but Baruch was counting them like stars. Part of the reason is the Torah wants to accentuate. In Shemos, they're family. By the end of Shemos, Kasher Yanuoso, Ken Yerbe, V'chen Yifrotz, all of a sudden this family of 70 has morphed into a nation of 3.5 million strong. For all of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov's accomplishment, through no blame, through no fault of their own, they weren't the head of a nation. Moshe will lead a nation. A nation fulfilling its destiny, Votzeisi, Vitzalti, Vigalti, Vilakachti, a nation fulfilling its covenant, Vigam Hakimosi, but also a nation which is composed not only of saints, but of sinners. Not only of righteous people, but of evildoers. Not just of believers, but with betrayers. Not just strong, but weak. Not just the Aarons and the Miriams, but the Dustin and Abirams. Not just those who rally, the Zekanim who rally around Moshe and listen to his call, but the naysayers. Lo shamu al Moshe mikotzer rach me'avodah kasha. That is an entirely different experience than that of a family. Even if in your family you've got a son or a daughter or a member of your family who isn't as... It's a different fabric. It's a different dynamic. All of a sudden, you're tasked, Moshe Rabbeinu, with leading a nation, people who aren't related to you in the direct sense, who don't have that intimate bond that's formed over dinners and over walks in the park. You don't really know them, and you have to tolerate them. You have to love them. You have to defend them. You have to interact with them. You have to suffer with them. That's not something that Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov ever were exposed to. Again, through no fault of their own. They're in a very different historical stage. But here's the challenge, Moshe Rabbeinu. Here's the challenge. The more involved you are in their comings and goings, the more of me you'll see. Because that's the irony. You'd think that to really understand Hashem, you'd have to be pure and unsullied and be stuck in some ivory tower far away from the adulterating influences of a larger nation with its reign of people, some of whom are strongly committed and some of whom... You'd think that that's the way to hone your purity, to protect, to preserve it. It's an ivory tower, insulated, distant, quarantined. You may have to interact with the people, but that's just your obligation, your duty. But the real place to find a Kodesh Baruch Hu is in quiet chambers of private study, private sanctity, protecting yourself against the contaminating influence of those around you. And Hashem says, no, to get more of me, the more committed you are to this people, the more you tolerate them, the more you love them, the more you defend them, the more of me you'll see. The more committed you are to a Jewish destiny, a person relates to our Kodesh Baruch Hu. This is the message tonight. And I hope it's a message that some of you are returning, so you feel it deeper, you've tasted it. Some of us just started the year. We have a lot of boys who just came back from South Africa. Anyone from Australia? Australia also come from Australia, came back for a couple of weeks to be here for their summer. So guys, welcome to your summer. This is real Mesiras Nefesh. It came from, wonderful beaches and wonderful climate to be here for the summer. You relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu not just as an individual through your mitzvos, through your davening, through your Torah, but you relate as part of a people, as part of a nation, carrying a mission, walking through history, suffering through history. It's not just tit for tat. Hashem says, the more committed you are to my people, the more of a reward I'll give you, the more of you, more of me I'll let you see. It's not a reward, it's not artificial. Show me your selflessness. Show me your commitment. Show me your relentlessness. Show me how much you love these people, and then in exchange, I'll let you see more of me. Your experience with HaKadosh Baruch Hu changes when you experience the Ribbono Shel Olam not as an individual outside of time and history, but as part of a people that has a path, that has a bris. We've said so many times that the role of davening goes far beyond how strong or weak your kavana is. It's a sense of community. We've davened Elokeinu v'Elokei Avoseinu, our fathers davened, my Zaydi davened, Abraham davened, I stood next to my father in davening, I learned about davening from him, I try to teach my children davening. Davening gives you that sense of continuity, of community, that we're part of a nation, that we're part of historical struggle, that part of our Judaism is expressed by identifying with the struggle. I mean, don't look around you because it's dark outside, but sometimes when I'm in the States and I'm trying to discuss the yeshiva, particularly with parents who are concerned with the location, and I'm very overt in saying, this is the only, not the only, but the only one of two major Hesder yeshivas that have overseas programs that are located in the Shtachim. I don't care about Neon yet, it's a major overseas program. But Grisha Malei Adumim, or we want to feel like we're part of building the settlements, and we're part of repopulating our land. We're part of, this is something I want your sons, when they're in yeshiva, to identify with strongly. That's not the Gush that I came to 25 years ago with an outpost and during Shmirah without a gate. You'd have to go to Karmitzur. You'd have to go to southern Hebron Hills to taste that. But you're part of something larger. And one day you'll come back with your children and you'll show them, oh, I remember when Efrat and Neveh Daniel weren't connected. I remember when there really was a Neveh Daniel and before it was absorbed and gobbled up by Alon Shavuot or becoming part of one large Gush metropolis with different neighborhoods. I remember when you couldn't walk from Gush to Neveh Daniel and Shabbos, which you can, but something like that. I remember when you couldn't walk from Gush to Efrat and Shabbos. When we wanted to walk to Efrat, we had to make a Klum Shabbos. We had to put food down on a rock because it was more than Alpayim Amah. from the outskirts of Alon Shua to the outskirts of Efrat. Today you can walk. Obviously, you have to be careful how you walk, or who you walk. This isn't that invitation to walk. But in terms of Chum Shabbos, we have to make an Erev Chumen. We have to make an Erev Chumen in order to walk. So Hashem is telling Moshe Rabbeinu, now all of a sudden the prism by through which you see me changes. And the other ones had a vision of this, but they didn't experience it. Moshe's going to experience it. And this sets off a litany of situations, a legacy of moments in Moshe's career that are characterized by one common denominator. Every time he shows that deeper commitment to a Jewish experience beyond himself, and he's willing to sacrifice his own stake, and his own share, and his own title, and his own future for the larger community of Am Yisrael, all of a sudden, miraculously, his vision of HaKadosh Baruch Hu becomes clearer, his understanding, his comprehension of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is upgraded. This is the beginning. So, for example, in a few weeks, I don't think I'll be here that written. Will I be here? I think I will still be here for this year. We'll talk about it a little bit now. Parshas Yisrael. Parshas Yisrael, Matan Torah, is not just a celebration of a Kodesh Baruch Hu delivering Torah to Am Yisrael. Not all people were created equal on Vav Sivan. Everyone was equal except for one person. Who was the one person who was unequal? Moshe Rabbeinu. We were shaking in our boots. We were terrified. We could hardly see. We were fainting. We were dying from fear. And we saw Moshe Rabbeinu freely walking into the cloud. And this was intended, this wasn't incidental. Because Har Sinai is a moment not just to establish the divinity of Torah Shebichtav, but the authority of Rabbanim to interpret it. Moshe Rabbeinu is the first Rebbe, he's the first rabbi in Jewish history, and he has to have that authority. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe, Ba'avur yishmah ha'am b'debri imach, I want them to see me speaking with you. V'gam b'chay amin ol olam, and through them seeing me speaking with you, they'll trust you forever. Trust Moshe forever? Moshe's going to die. Now, Moshe is not going to live forever, but the symbol of Moshe, rabbinic authority, I told you a couple of weeks ago, that's the trifecta of orthodoxy. To be an Orthodox Jew, you have to subscribe to the divinity of Torah, to the authority of Chazal, and to the basic 13 principles of theology. If you subscribe to those three, you're Orthodox. You may have a view that I disagree with, you may have a view that's dangerous, but if you betray one of those three, you're not Orthodox. You betray rabbinic authority, you're betraying Har Sinai. Harsina is not just the delivery of the divine code, but it's the empowerment and the authorization of Rabbanim to interpret it, and that's why rabbinic authority is so crucial to orthodoxy. We won't budge. We can't just walk away from what Chazal told us. We could try to interpret it and reinterpret it and find a chiddush and a svara, but we don't just turn our backs because it was 2,000 years ago. So Parshas Yisrael celebrates Moshe Rabbeinu. It's not just celebrating Torah, but a celebration of Moshe's status in Harsina. And yet it begins in such a pedestrian manner. How does Parshas Yisrael begin? Yisrael coming to visit Moshe, bringing his wife, bringing his children, watching Moshe Rabbeinu attend to the questionings and the needs of the Jewish people day and night. So to make matters short and brief, we'll talk about this a little bit in Yisrael. But without the introduction of Parshas Yisrael, we can't appreciate Moshe's spiritual achievements in Har Sinai. In order for Moshe to walk up that mountain and see HaKadosh Baruch Hu as clearly as he does, he first has to demonstrate the willingness to stand from morning till evening attending to the needs of the Jewish people, as silly as they may be, because they hadn't received the Torah yet. It's not like they were asking big kashas about Gittin and Lashma and Sefer Krisus. They didn't receive the Torah yet. They were very fledgling. They were very immature. What were they asking here? They were very immature religiously. Part of understanding Sefer Shemos, and I didn't get a chance to talk about it last week's Parsha, is religious maturity is not something that evolves immediately. It's not an immediate quantum leap, but you start to learn about a Kodesh Baruch Hu and you develop. So for example, in Parsha Shemos, part of what's blocking Moshe's ability to dispatch the Jewish people, he asks a Kodesh Baruch Hu, how will I describe you to them? They're slaves. They're religiously undereducated. They're unsophisticated. I can see a burning bush. But I grew up in the house of Pyro. I have a sophisticated intellect. I can see and understand an abstract God. But how will I describe you to them? And in truth, part of what HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells them is, Hey, Asher, hey, don't try to describe me to them. Just tell them stories about their Zadi and Babi. Remember the God of Akedah. Remember their Rebbe Shalom of Sulam Yaakov, of Yaakov and Beit El. Remember HaKadosh Baruch Hu being there during the flood of Noah, during the Mabul of Noah. Hey, yeah, I was there for your fathers. I'll be there for you. Don't try to tell them theology. Don't try to discuss philosophy with them. Everyone has stories about their Zadis and their Babis and their parents and their ancestors. I'm the Rebbe Shalom of their ancestors. Once they see 10 Makos, 12, 10 Makos, once they leave Mitzrayim, once they see Kriyas Yamsa, Remember, the makos are intended not just to punish Paro. The makos are intended to demonstrate monotheism to a world audience as well as to the Jewish people. The Jewish people are also the audience of the makos. They're also learning about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So, for example, it's not on your sheets, but just by way of example. Remember, every year in the Haggadah, we recite a pasuk. Okay, Biyad Chazaka, Rizoy Netuya, Uvimar Gadol, Uviyosel Sivimovsin. This is a pasuk from Kisavo describing the Yitzias Mitzrayim in brief term. It's a pasuk which you recite when you bring Bikurim into the Beis HaMikdash. Arami Ovi Avi, Vayir Gnesayim Avi, Yisein Hashem Alkein Misham, Biyad Chazaka, Zoy Netuya, Uvimar Gadol, Uviyosel Sivimovsin. So how does Haggadah interpret Yad Chazaka? Anyone remember Yad Chazaka? No, that's the end, drasha. The first drasha, which the Haggadah, written or a compilation of Mamari Chazal, the first drasha of Yad Chazaka is Yad Chazaka? Yad Chazaka? Zoha Dever. Yad Chazaka is a reference to Dever. Shenemar, Hine Yad Hashem Haya B'miknecha. Pasuk in this week's parsha, that the Chaitumi Mitzrayim, when they saw Dever, they said, the Yad Hashem is here. Of all the makos to refer to Yad Chazaka, why is Dever called Yad Chazaka? So what's the classic shot, one of the shots Chazal say? Why is Dever called Yad Chazaka? Of all the makos, why is it singled out as Yad Chazaka? Egyptian pagan gods. So this was a really overwhelmingly convincing triumph for HaKadosh Baruch Hu over Egyptian deities. But in addition to that, there's another reason that Dever is called Yad Chazaka. Egyptians were paganists. This is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's attempt to introduce monotheism. The first principle of monotheism is that you can't see HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He's invisible, he's transcendent, he's unknowable, he's inscrutable. Of all the makos, guys, which maka had the least physical, tangible element to it? Which maka was completely invisible? They were smitten, they were slaughtered, but there's nothing visible that they could pinpoint. Dever, and then ultimately makos b'chorus. Shchin was ashes, thrown up in heaven, turning into boils. Everything had a physical correlative. Everything had a physical reference point. The water turning to blood, the frogs leaping out of the Nile, the wild animals invading. Everything had something physical to it, even the barak, even the choshech. Chazal, the pasuk is very intense, very clear, v'yamesh choshech, that the choshech was palpable. It's a palpable darkness. Dever was the first, and before Makos B'chorus, the most blatantly or glaringly non-physical. It was a viral, it was a virus, it was something. HaKadosh Baruch Hu through Dever was directing Egyptian attention to the fact that there's a world that we can't see with our eyes that's nonetheless very powerful, very impactful, very causative, very overwhelming, as humanity would learn throughout the Middle Ages, bubonic plagues, it's a black plagues. This was the first time that the Egyptian culture was able to sense that the world isn't just Nile rivers and reptiles and suns, the Osiris and the Ra god, but there's a very powerful world that the human eye can't grasp, can't see. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu was teaching them about the notion of an invisibility. And that just like there's a powerful microbe that you can't see that can wreak havoc upon your population, not just your cattle, but your population, it can sow fear into your hearts, you can't see me. And in order to accentuate or highlight that point, what did HaKadosh Baruch Hu call that maka? Yad Chazaka. He was demonstrating to the Egyptians, when I warn you about my Yad Chazaka, you're probably expecting a big hand to come down from heaven and sweep you up. Because that's how you're trained to think of God, as hands and feet. But I will show you that my Yad Chazaka really isn't physical. My Yad Chazaka, because I'm not physical. You can describe my hand in allegoric terms, but I don't have a hand. My Yad Chazaka will be Deva. My Yad Chazaka will be invisible, will be impalpable. And that's precisely why the Egyptian magic was unable to duplicate the makos beginning with Kinim and Dever. Because Egyptian magic, black magic, was premised on paganism. And paganism is premised on the world of material. So when it had to do with converting water into blood, they were able to replicate it. To do with converting the Nile River into a festering pond of amphibious invaders, they were able to do that. But all of a sudden, as the material shrunk, as it did in Kenan, and then it completely disappeared, as it did in Dever, their pagan-based magic had no answer. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu was slowly working the Egyptians and Am Yisrael into a state that I will assert my Yad Chazaka. What do the Egyptian Chartumim say when they see Kenan? Hinei? Etzvah Lukidmi. they're first realizing that Hashem's etzba is not really physical, like their reptile gods or like their sun in the sky. This is Hashem taunting and teaching the Egyptians, my etzba is almost minuscule, you'll hardly see it, it's a kingdom. And my yad is something you won't see at all. And then, Josh, the phrase yad chazaka appears not just in Parshas Kisava describing Yetzias Mitzrayim, but where else does it appear? The last pasuk in the Torah? What's the last pasuk in the Torah? That phrase Yad Chazaka in Parshas Kitzos Tadracha, Chazal interpret Josh as a reference to Malchus Malchus. So the phrase Yad Chazaka in Kisaba, the Baal HaGadol interprets as a reference to Deva, and the word Yad Chazaka in Parshas Kitzos Tadracha, because there's a continuity between the two, because together they demonstrate the lack of something palpable. In fact, it's actually very interesting. The Medrash says, and this is not what I intended to speak about with Zaparsha's Svarim, that Dever was not just a Makkah, but Dever was a backdrop Makkah to every single Makkah. I think it's Yeshua ben Levi. Every single Makkah was accompanied by Dever. And that's a term, its terminology is very generic, it's a Davar, it's a thing, it's a backdrop rather than every single Or, except from the word Dibor as well, in Chassidus and Kabbalah, it's part of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's message to the Egyptian. Every single Makkah was accompanied by Dever. Because Dever is purpose, and Makkas Baharis is purpose. So Kadosh Baruch Hu is teaching Egyptian, Jew, and world audience. This is Kadosh Baruch Hu's grand debut, in fact. Part of the reason we were redeemed, even though we didn't deserve to be redeemed, is because this was a moment in time that couldn't be forfeited. So much energy had been invested in teaching the Mediterranean Crescent about Kadosh Baruch Hu. And Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov's efforts were successful. Lavan sees it through Yaakov, and the people of Hebron see it through Avram, and the people on the coast see it through Yitzchak, but power remains defined. Mi Hashem Hashem Shema B'Tolo. And this is a chance for the march, I keep using that phrase, the march of monotheism. As much as we suffer, and we have suffered at the hands of Christianity and Islam, we live in a monotheistic world. We live in a world that's the byproduct of so many years of struggle against paganism. We live in a world of ration, a world of science, a world of monotheism. Obviously there are corrections, alterations, there are adjustments that have to be made, more so to Christianity, less so to Islam theologically. There are great adjustments that Islam still needs morally and experience and politically, but theologically it's closer to pure monotheism than Christianity. But at least appreciate the advance. As much as we're warring with Islam, and to a degree we have been warring with Christianity for 2,000 years, appreciate them as accomplishments of the theological process, rather, and don't throw out the baby with the bathwater, as we would say. So Kodesh Baruch has to teach the Jewish people about who he is, and their maturity will grow, and they'll see more of their volitional. Finally, at the Yom Sof, and we'll talk about this, they'll say something they were utterly incapable of saying in Mitzrayim. What are the four words they first utter at the Yom Sof? And this is part of the Yom Sof. Four words that they couldn't utter in Mitzrayim, and this becomes the first time in history those four words are uttered. Adonai Yimloch Le'olam Va'ed. They don't say that in Mitzrayim. They're incapable of saying that. They're capable of gratitude. They're capable of feeling redeemed. But all of a sudden they see Malchus. And that's the first pasuk we recite when we recite Malchus of Rosh Hashanah. We take ourselves back to Kriyas Yamzah when they recited Hashem Yimloch Le'olam Va'ed. So it's that learning curve. And they're learning about a Kodesh Baruch Hu. But they're still immature. Moshe isn't answering sophisticated questions about how to pasuk in Basu B'chol. He's answering simple ideas. They're thirsting to learn about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he's providing some basic solutions. And yet he's there all morning, and he's there all night, and he's there from early dawn till late midnight. And without seeing Moshe, source number of days, in the beginning of Yisrael, Vahimi Maharat, Vayeshev Moshe Lishpot Atam, Vayamod Amal Moshe Min HaBokir Ad HaArev, Vayomer Chotein Moshe Elav, Lo Tov Adavar Asher Atel Sef, Naval Tibol, you'll wilt, you'll fade, You'll be broken by this work labor, by this work ethic. Gamata, gama mazer shemcha, kicha veimcha, davar lotucha lasau livadecha. So Yisro has to help Moshe make adjustments, because no man is Superman. No one's going to burn the candle at both ends. But Moshe wants to, and he tries his hardest. Oh, that's the Moshe we see in the beginning of Yisro. That's the Moshe who walks up to Har Sinai and sees HaKadosh Baruch Hu in ways unknown to man before him. Do you see the line between Va'er and Yisro? In Va'era, Moshe sees Yerkevavke. In Yisro, he sees more. Don't ask me to tell you what he sees, but he sees more. Can't tell you. He sees more than he witnesses in Parshas Yisro. Because all of a sudden in Yisro, he isn't just taking the reins of a nation, he's actually, in real time, annihilating himself, his needs, his schedule, for the needs of a fledgling, yet-to-be-matured nation and its religious inquiries. And that's the lesson of Parshas Vayera. The more you see of this people, the more committed you are to a national ethic, a national experience, you are by definition, not by reward, by definition, you are experiencing me through an entirely different dimension, and you're seeing more of me. And then it reaches its climax to a degree in Parshas Ki Tisa. Because Parshas Ki Tisa is a very dark moment for the Jewish people until Moshe really heroically saves an entire nation in their experience. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu offers Moshe, I will start again. I will destroy these people. HaKadosh Baruch Hu turns to Moshe like this. This is a pasuk in Sefer Devarim, but it describes the event in Ki Tisa. Hashem is saying like this. Haref mi meni, leave me alone. Pash mi day. Don't bother davening. Haref mi meni. Don't you dare daven. Haref mi meni, pash mi day. Don't even try. Leave me alone. Haref mi meni, and I'm going to destroy them. I'll turn you into a new nation. Now, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu told me, Haref mi meni, pash mi day. Leave me alone, I'll destroy them, I'll start again with you. I'm saying, where do I sign? Think about an offer you can't refuse. You know, I'll be the founding member of the Jewish people. I'll be on every dollar bill. You know, there'll be birthdays. I'll celebrate my brother. Harry Manny Rashmi did, and Moshe doesn't take the bait. Moshe davens, and he davens, and it reaches that point where Moshe says, source number Gimel, Vayashav Moshe al Hashem. So Moshe returns, okay, I'm back to respond to your offer. I know you made me an offer. Here I am. Here's my response. Moshe is very clear. If you forgive them, great. Then we can continue. If you don't forgive them, I'm gone. I'm with them. You wanna destroy them? I'm with them. You make your choice, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I'm with them. I'm hitching my wagon to them. You want to start again? Your choice. I can't tell you what to do. You're HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I'm just a human being. Well, one day I can tell you. You want me? You get them. You don't want them, you don't get me. And that is precisely what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to hear. That was the setup. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was yearning to hear that. And what happens right after that moment in Ki Tisa? Not just Salach Nikivarech on a national level, but Ani Avir Kol Tuvi Al Panecha. Now it's not just Yud Kei Vav Kei Vaera, and it's not just what you saw, the colors of Rakim of Har Sinai. Ani avir kol tuvi al panecha. You're going to see more of me than any human being called to me. V'karasi b'shem Hashem l'fanecha. V'ra'isa sachora. You'll see the back of my head, which is a crazy idea when it comes to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we don't even know how to interpret it, but that's how much Moshe saw. V'ra'isa sachora. Hareini nas kivodecha. Hodieini nas drechecha. Moshe Benu was one of the most audacious requests ever. Show me your kavod. Teach me your ways. That's only because Moshe Rabbeinu annihilated himself, suppressed and submerged his own identity within a larger collective. That's exactly what I want, exactly what I want from you. And that's what happens, guys, in Parshas Vayera. Vayera is the start of this whole process. Kodesh Baruch Hu descends to Moshe, Vayera l'Avram el Yitzchak v'el Yaakov v'kel Shakai u'shmi Hashem lo nodati lahem. You are saying Yud Kei Vav Kei, not for anything you accomplished. You didn't undergo an Akedah. You didn't run away from your parents for 20 years like Yaakov did. You didn't discover me like Avram did. But the game is changing. The equation is changing. You're the head of a nation, and you're going to have a challenge that others won't. And others didn't. And if you take a look back at source number Aleph, it's a very interesting pasuk that's grammatically very, very ambiguous. And Rashi and Chazal already tell us what this pasuk is intending. Hashem comes to Moshe, gives him the drill, teaches him Yud Kei Vav Kei, reminds him of this national calling. Look at the last pasuk. Okay. I have it here. Maybe I didn't. So Rashi is. I don't have the pasuk. Do you have a chumash here? You take a look in pasuk Yud. Make it clear. Do you have a chumash here? What's pasuk Yud? Pasuk Tes is the end of section Aleph. By Daber and Dri and Parag Vav. By Daber Hashem Ken on Moshe Ken on Bnei Yisrael Velo Shemol Moshe Mikot Keruach.
Right,
next pasuk. Okay, continue. By Yitzaveim Abnei Yisrael. It's on the
sheet?
Where? The first page, you're right. Right. Shmos Vav Yudgim. Right. Look at Shmos Sur Zion. Okay? Moshe listens to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, tries, is concerned by Dabem Moshe of Hashem Nimar. Hein B'nei Yisrael Eishamor Elei Ve'eich Shveni Paro Banir Al Sfasayim. They didn't listen to me. So his main concern is Paro. The Am Yisrael won't listen to me. Paro certainly won't listen to me. So Hashem sends him back. With the Baruch Hashem Moshe Ve'al Aaron. Vayitzaveim Al B'nei Yisrael Ve'al Paro Malach Mitzrayim. What message are they giving to the Jewish people? Vayitzaveim Al B'nei Yisrael. Moshe was concerned that Paro wouldn't listen. If Am Yisrael won't listen, Paro won't listen. So Hashem assures him, don't worry, go back to Paro, I'll convince him. What is the Pasuk, Perek Vav, Pasuk Yud Gimel, Sur Zayin, Hashem orders them to go speak to the Jewish people and then to go speak to Paro. Jewish people are part of the process of Machos. If you take a look at the next page, Rashi. El doesn't mean El, but Al. Here the word El doesn't mean two, but about. Vayitzaveim Al B'nei Yisrael, Tziva Aleihem, Lehanhigam B'nachas, Lelizbol Osam. You first told me that they're not going to listen to you because you're all sasayim and you're too busy working. You got frustrated by their obstinance and their intransigence. To be a leader, you have to be tolerant. To be a leader, you have to suffer those who are less committed than you, less brave, less visionary. So before I send you to Paro, Vayitzaveim Al B'nei Yisrael, you misspoke. You complained about the Jewish people. You complained they're not listening. You were deterred by their kotzer ruach and avodah kasha. First, be that leader that I spoke about a few pasukim before. Be that person who's committed to a national experience. Then, once you get that right, then you can go to Paro. Because you can't go to Paro until you're a leader. And you can't be a leader until you realize the savlanos and the forbearance and the tolerance and being able to bear siddur inside it. We've talked a lot in this setting, and I want to speak very quickly. I want to mention one other quick point to you. We've talked a lot in this setting about different hashkafos in the world, and different ways to be Obdei Hashem, and I hope that by now you've heard me tell you that there isn't one MS, and you have to find the MS that most excites you and that most characterizes who you are. But for me, this whole notion was an epiphany when I came to Yeshiva, and was part of the reason that I feel very aligned with the Dati Lumi approach, the sense that not just in spirit, but in action, in day-to-day experience, I feel like there's a commitment to a broader national historical reality of serving in the army, of living with secular as well as religious Jews, is feeling that basic fraternity. Because ultimately you pay a very heavy price. If you're honest with yourself, you pay a very, very heavy price of exposure, of contamination, of pollution, of polluting influences. But the sense that my relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not in any way contaminated by being part of a larger national experience, but able to feel HaKadosh Baruch Hu and identify with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, experience HaKadosh Baruch Hu through the prism of people, through the prism of nation, the prism of history, the prism of state, the prism of a larger experience which won't always be that patently religious and that pure, and that there'll be sinners and there'll be failures and there'll be golden calves, but Hashem wants you to be part of that and to tolerate that and to try to correct that and to try to daven on behalf of those people. And I'm sure a Haredi person will tell you, I feel that, but I don't want to live that in the day to day. I feel that I'm learning my Torah for that experience. I feel like when Mashiach comes, I'll have that experience. But right now, it's too high a price to pay. And right now, I'm not in any way, if not triumphalism, which is the Derech that's MS, because as you know, we've talked about there isn't one MS. But the MS for me was very, very deeply built upon this parsha and upon this recognition. When I came to yeshiva, when I started yeshiva, I was raised and educated in the Haredi setting, and I was unable in that setting to sense this larger equation. For me, the Torah was very sharp, the davening was very intense, the Yerushalayim was very, but all of a sudden I came here and I lived in this settlement with people who served in the army, and I found as if my entire interaction with the Kodesh Baruch Hu had been doubled, had been expanded. It wasn't just an arithmetic growth, it was an exponential growth. And I felt like now I'm feeling the Rabbanu Shalom in ways that I didn't feel before. So this was a very important transition for me. The second thing I want to talk about very briefly, very, very briefly, but just as important to me, is what you don't see in the text. Remember we talked about Parshas Ve'era as a new beginning. In the end of Parshas Shemos, Moshe attempts to convince Paro. And not only does he fail, say he failed at putting it mildly, he said, I'm just saying, it boomerangs. It's a ricochet. It's worse. Lama harosa lama zeh. Paro ridicules him. Paro scoffs at him. Paro defames him. Mi Hashem esher shema b'kolo. He immediately orders the Egyptian taskmasters to intensify, to augment the workload, the labor. Now they have to produce the same output without being given raw materials. Paro has set up friction and tension amongst the ranks because there are Egyptian shotrim that are ruling over Jewish noksim, or maybe I got it reversed, but there are Egyptian overlords who are now expecting Jewish kapos, to put it into Holocaust terminology, to enforce their cruel, cruel rules. So now there's infighting between Jews. And it has to be brilliant if you want to devastate a people, if you want to persecute a people. And this is all Moshe's responsibility. This is all on Moshe. And Moshe walks out of the power of Mitzrayim, and he gets hooted and hollered at. And you can imagine the Jews throwing rotten tomatoes at him, and how dare you, you false Messiah. And then all of a sudden, Parshas Era begins again, with a brand new, bold, new theological introduction for Era. You have to sense this guy. Sometimes you read it too quickly. You have to sense the break, the fissure between Shmos and Era. What should have happened naturally is Era should have been, Kadosh Baruch Hu telling Moshe, get back in the ring, go back, round two, try again. As happens in Va'era, when Moshe is concerned that the Jewish people won't listen in power, won't listen in terms of no spill though. So there are times when Moshe has to be recalibrated, and Moshe has to be sent back into the ring. But Va'era is not just sending Moshe back into the ring, it's restarting the whole process. So part of it is the theological reorientation that I just mentioned, but part of it is historical. Chazal say, it's a medrash. Let's see if we can read the medrash, just to show you this medrash. To me, it's one of the most memorable medrashim that Rav Amital taught us. If you take a look at the last source, page 2, side 2, medrash in Brachos in the Midbar Rabbah. I'll skip the allegory to the Tzvi, we'll talk about it later. Okay? Hagol HaRisha, line 3, source science, is a medrash. Second page, back side. Hagol HaRisha Zemoshe. Nigla Lahem revealed himself to the Jewish people, v'chazer v'nichse mehem, and then he was concealed. Kama nichse mehem, Rabbi Tanchuma Amar, shlosha chadashim. Moshe, after being scoffed at, after failing in Parsha Shmos, returns to Midian for 3 months, to Yisrael's house. Or according to some doubts in Chazal, 6 months. And 6 months later, he returns, and Va'era's new fresh start captures the fact that it really was chronologically a fresh start. 6 months elapsed between Shmos and Va'era. We think Moshe gets hooted, goes home, has a good dinner, puts himself together, and gets back up the next day and tries again. Va'era happened 6 months after Shmos. Now imagine you were living as a Jew, enslaved to the Egyptians, and you witnessed this affair. And you watch Moshe flee to Midian with his tail between his legs. What would you have assumed? Ho-hum. Another false Messiah. Another failed Redeemer. Another meaningless attempt. And the slavery will continue. And the burden will be worse. In 2020 hindsight, it wasn't a regression. It was a slight pause. What's 3 months or 6 months in the sleep of history? It's a hiccup. The point is, our expectations of redemption sometimes are unrealistic. I say the word redemption, you think apocalypse, you think immediate, you think overnight, you think a total sea change, Armageddon, black and white. And sometimes Geula is staged, and sometimes it's phased, and part of those phases could be stalled. When the Geula stalls or lags, and sometimes not just a lag or a pause, but even regression. That doesn't mean it isn't redemptive. It just means you're at a down part of the curve. When it's stalling or pausing or even regressing a bit. And that is perhaps one of the most important lessons that we have to learn and should learn in the last 20 years of Israeli history. Because 1948 to 19, let's make a round figure, 1948 to 1990, let's say, was mercurial, was meteoric, was quick, was redemptive, was otherworldly, was messianic. 5 military victories, recapturing land, the old city, the Kotel, the backwaters of Jewish history, Beit El, Shechem, Gush Etzion, Beit Lechem. It was just miraculous, otherworldly. And the last 20 years have been frustrating. Terror, setbacks, expulsions, the disintegration of the fabric of society, the struggles and the tensions and hostilities that we've experienced between ourselves. And there's so many people, this experience sours them to the notion of Gula. This can't be Gula. This can't be Reish Smichas Gula Seinu. Because how can we evict Jews from Asa? How can we suffer so miserably if this were redemptive? How can there be so many struggles and tensions and hostilities amongst Jews? It can't be redemptive because our expectations of redemption are unrealistic. And part of the message of Parshas Vayera is that there are redemptions that are immediate and there are redemptions that are more phased. And you just have to have patience, and you may not see it in your day, you may not see it in your lives. Maybe you will, maybe you won't. Maybe I will, maybe I won't. We're seeing the first seed of redemption means that what we are building will factor into the ultimate Gula. Not just in some very, very indirect sense, as let's say events in the second century factored into Gula through some very indirect causality. But by coming back to this land, and building a yeshiva like this, and building communities, and building an army, building a state, that is going to eventually, could be 20 years from now, could be 2 years from now, could be 200 years from now, I don't know. But we're building the foundation. This is going to be a direct, we're not going to be evicted from this land. We have a Masorah, there won't be a third Korban. So we've returned to this land. Everything else is on the table. Can there be a nuclear attack on Israel? Be'ezus Hashem, there won't be. But there could be. Could there be great savagery and there could be. Hopefully there won't be. It all depends on our behavior. But this return is starting a process. It could be a long, long developing process. But we've started a process. A direct process. But there could be setbacks. Doesn't make it less divine. Doesn't make it less messianic. We'll just read one pasuk. Take a look at page 2. The pasuk from this week's Haftarah. Oh, not this week's Haftarah, excuse me. One of the Haftarahs is divine. So again, it's page 2, back side. The pasuk is actually titled on the front side, from Yeshaya Nun Beis. Osei. Hashem tells us, you should know, the final Geula won't be like Mitzrayim. And how does Hashem tell us this in Yeshaya Nun Beis? Ki lo b'chipazon teitzeyu. Unlike Mitzrayim, which was chipazon, you will not be redeemed, blessed love of the chipazon. And you won't run. Hashem will walk before you. Israel will walk behind you, but there'll be a pace, and he'll set the pace. You'll walk in the middle. Your behavior, Hashem will be in the front, Hashem will be in the back, and he'll set the pace by your behavior. Hashem is cautioning us. Don't have untrue or unrealistic expectations of Gula Achrona. It won't be like Mitzrayim, which was Chipazon. Guys, even Mitzrayim, which was Chipazon, had a 6-month lag. Even Chipazon of Mitzrayim had a setback. Alachas kama v'kama. A gula asida, gula achrona, which is described as the antithesis of Chipazon. Ki yalob Chipazon peitzeil. Alachas kama v'kama. There could be pauses, there could be lags, there could be phases, there could be setbacks, there could be tragedies. But if there aren't. It's such an important lesson because I don't know what the future holds. Mir Hashem, we should turn around tomorrow and see the chipazon part of our gula. But when it doesn't happen, if it doesn't happen, it shouldn't dull your redemptive fervor. It just means it's a struggle. And it's something worth fighting for, something worth sacrificing for, something worth being part of, even if you don't live in this country. To live this country's experience as part of your religious identity, realize that it can't just be how black my tefillin are, how big my lulav is, and how many pages of the Gemara I know, but there's a nation that we're building and a national destiny that we're forging. And that is to capture my energy and my interests also. And even if I don't live here, how can I be part of that? So those are the two related messages of Parshas Vayera and its beginning. The new theological introduction, which is a direct outcome of Moshe's sacrifice for a people, for a nation. Not a reward, but an outcome, a result. And the transition from Shemos to Vayera takes either 3 or 6 months, and imagine yourself living as a Jew in Egypt and assuming Geula had ended and waking up 3 months later and watching the sea split. Well, you could see the sea split tomorrow. It may happen, may not. You have to be prepared for it. Jew lives a dual life. He lives in the here and now, and he lives an apocalyptic other vision that could happen in a flash. And between now and the time it takes you to get to the Beis Medrash for Maariv, we could be in Yerushalayim with the Beis HaMikdash. It could happen any second. But you can't be lost in apocalypse and escape reality and running through an apocalypse. You've got to live those two realities. You've got to have like a double pane, a double screen. This is my reality. I'm working at it. I'm perfecting it. My redemption is just around the corner. And the Yad Hashem could change reality overnight. Stop here.